To EDF Action Campaign Academy session 6. We're calling this section Winning the Argument. And here are Joe Bonfilio and Tony Krendler, both with EDF. Joe is currently the president of EDF Action. He's in his 7th year at this organization. And prior to that, he served a variety of political communications and management roles for 3 different members of the US House and Senate. Krendler is the Senior Director of Government Relations at EDF. He's spent the last 10 years working with members of both parties to advance environmental solutions. Prior to joining EDF, he was CEO of a news company, and he served 10 years as a reporter covering Congress and the executive branch. So with that, Joe and Tony, take it away.
All right, Mr. Krendler, let's do this thing.
Thank you, Joe. One thing to always keep in the back of your mind in environmental policy issues is that they're all complicated. There is no simple solution to any given environmental problem. They often involve trade-offs, but more often than not, they give you the ability to connect very directly to the value systems that your voters hold dear. The environment is the neighborhood in which they live. It's the woods, streams, and wetlands where your family and kids play and fish in some cases. And the best way to win the argument on environmental values is to stay close to your personal value system and to connect it to your voters' value systems. And so don't overcomplicate things. Talk about what you care about. Talk about why clean air and clean water is good for you, it's good for your voters, and it's good for their families. What do you think, Joe?
I think it's exactly right. And, you know, I like starting here because I think this is the safest way to get both your positions out in a campaign setting. And, you know, it allows you to talk about environmental issues, even if you're not an environmental expert like Tony is. It allows you to talk about these issues in a way that that you feel really comfortable. And I think voters sort of pick up on that. So first things first, it is all about values, because I think that is one of the best ways to present as a candidate to connect with people that are electing you or sort of hiring you for this job.
Yeah, and at the same time, look, your average voter probably cares about water quality, whether they live on the East Coast, the West Coast, or somewhere in the middle. But they're not going to care so much if you've got an elaborate policy solution to too much nitrogen in the waterways. And talking about the things that you care about gives you the opportunity to connect them without being boring or overly policy specific.
All right, if you're explaining you're losing, this is a Tony line.
That's true. Actually, that was a Bill Clinton line, but it still holds true oh so many years later.
Let's move on. I'll start here. You know, this is something that we found in polling that I think a lot of candidates don't quite get. It is really, really hard to disqualify yourself in the eyes of voters if you talk about supporting the environment. There are, I would say, no safe issues when it comes to political campaigning. But if you're looking at one of the safer ones, talking about why you support the clean air and clean water around you, your community, and kids and grandparents, nothing safer than that. But it is very easy to sort of almost talk about environmental issues and miss voters completely. And that's, I think, what we sort of want to spend a little bit of time thinking about today with the candidates here. You know, I think you have to see, let's say, the forest and the trees here. You have to sort of know where what your voters are thinking and how to connect with them. And a lot of times, especially if you're running in a race down ballot, that you sort of read elite media, New York Times, or whatever's sort of popping on Twitter, and a lot of these sort of big sweeping national issues, and you're like, I should talk about those. Maybe not. And in many cases, you probably shouldn't. And you should be focused entirely on the needs and concerns of your community. And if at all possible, ignore some of those big sweeping national trends.
Right, and you know, I think environment in particular is a fascinating political issue because there are undercurrents in the headlines that speak to national issues, but the only people that are really thinking about those are the voters who lie on the extremes on either end of the political spectrum. And so if you talk about climate change, that does trigger a response that's associated with either some very good things or some very not good things, but that's only on the edges, right? In the middle, where the voters are, and where the voters are that you need to get elected, they actually will give you quite a bit of latitude on environmental issues. I like to think of it sort of as elasticity in the electorate, if that makes sense to people. We started here by saying, Joe mentioned that it's very hard to disqualify yourself on environmental issues, and that's true because voters basically assume that they and you and every American is a conservationist and an environmentalist. And that is a good thing, and they want to hear you speak to that in some way. While it's hard to disqualify yourself, though, it is pretty easy to commit an unforced error. And we see this all the time on both sides of the aisle. Republicans who are thinking about those voters on the extreme edge of the political spectrum and say something that in voters' minds disqualifies them from mainstream science, for example. That's an unforced error. You don't have to question environmental values and science as a Republican. You can speak to the value system that you want to speak to. Democrats, I believe, do this too. I think Joe's seen it in the campaigns that he's run. The risk with Democratic candidates is to go too far to the national policy side of the environmental equation, to talk about environment in the milieu of geopolitics or the national economy. That's not what voters are thinking about. Voters on both sides, when they think of the environment, again, they think of their community, they think of the stream, they think of the park in their neighborhood, they think of the air they breathe and the water they drink. And if you stick to that, you're going to win.
One more thing we flag here on the slide is voters don't see environment as a binary choice. And let's just sort of put, you know, let's just put some words to that. A lot of times people try to pick a fight. Well, if you're for the environment, you're clearly against jobs. No, it's not. That's not what it is at all. And in many cases, voters are not expecting you to make that choice. They expect a clean environment and they expect you to grow the economy. It's that simple. And most voters are gonna believe you if you're arguing that you can do both and should be doing both.
That's right. And I think anybody who's running for office, be it at the local level or the congressional level or even the national level, should take the time to find a couple of examples in their district, in their state, in their community, where businesses are actually creating jobs to address environmental problems. And some of these, you know, are fairly obvious. Obviously, we've got companies like SolarCity out there putting solar panels on people's roofs. Those right. are real jobs. Sometimes they're a little less obvious, but they're there and they're there every. In states where agriculture is a dominant part of the economy, there are high-tech companies. Even some of the larger ones that you know about, like John Deere and Caterpillar, who are making technologies and tractors that actually are more efficient and are more efficient with the use of things like fertilizer. Up and down the East Coast, we have companies now that are making small rubber gaskets that go into energy efficient air conditioners. These are all environmental issues. They are directly connected to the local economy, and it's a very safe and very productive place from which to talk about these issues.
Let's move on to the next slide because somewhere there's a campaign manager that wants a candidate to get back to call time and stop listening to us. So let's move on. All right, let's talk about interacting with the press. I think from our intros, what some folks here want to know is we've both worked either as members of the media themselves or as press flacks. My early career was working directly with candidates and press. And let's give some people a couple tips. We'll start here with understanding the press.
Let's do it. I think I want to start with the first thing that is bulleted on this slide, which is that journalists today, reporters in general, are much busier than they used to be. Now, 10 years ago, a reporter would either be working on a short piece for the daily paper, maybe a long-form piece for a magazine or a newspaper. Today, every reporter wakes up in the morning, is expected to blog, is expected to tweet, is expected to feed a 24/7 news cycle on the internet website that represents their paper or television station or radio station. At the same time, they're expected to go on TV and go on radio and basically squeeze in where they can the story that they're on deadline for. And so recognizing how busy they are and being prepared to be very precise, brief, and helpful to the reporters that are working today is your best chance of being both successful in what you're trying to do on any given day or in the long run in your relationships with the press.
So I think the next couple bullets here are really important because they're a little nuts and boltsy, but I like them. And the first thing is that the way people are communicating with each other is changing rapidly. Sending a press release and expecting reporters are just going to pick it up and run with it. Those days are over. In many ways, reporters are getting flooded with email and press releases, and many have beats that are wide ranging. So just having your campaign send out a press release and then waiting for a reporter to bite is not gonna work. It's not gonna happen. You know, just as journalists are using other ways of communicating with people. Those are also ways you need to communicate with journalists. Twitter and other social media platforms are really excellent ways to get your message and yourself in front of journalists. I remember when journalists used to direct message me on Twitter or start posting, with my Twitter handle on Twitter just to get my attention because they wanted a quote. I thought to myself, that was pretty good. I'm gonna flip that on its head and start using Twitter to reach out to members of the media.
Right.
Let's keep going. Aha.
I love this slide because it's a good reminder that journalists are people too, and they're not some sort of scary animal. They're actually human beings with feelings and who respond to the same sort of relationship cues that we all do in our personal lives and our professional lives. So always approach journalists with the respect that you would give to anybody that you want to have a working relationship with. Look, there's always going to be an adversarial piece to a press conversation because it's reporters' jobs to get information that other reporters aren't getting and beat people with the story. And so, you know, you'll find some aggressive ones, but they're still people. And so this is almost sort of like a moral golden code issue here. If a reporter reaches out, respond quickly. We've talked about how precious their time is. Your time is precious too. A quick response is going to build a lot of goodwill because they know that you were treating them as somebody who is worth their time, frankly. They'll be more generous with their time if you're more generous with your time. They also value honesty. Reporters can smell two things pretty quickly. One is fear, and that can always turn against you, and honesty. And so never try to hide the ball with a reporter. If there's something you don't want to talk about, be clear that you don't want to talk about it, but don't resort to, you know, what could be obvious evasionary tactics to avoid talking about something. Be clear, be honest, be quick, and be good.
I think that right now there are a lot of bad bad lessons out there. We see some national politicians doing some things that we would never recommend. You're not gonna win a fight with a reporter. Berating someone or impugning their judgment or their motive is probably not gonna work. I'll say this. I'll take this one. You don't want to call them fake. That's not going to endear you to the reporter covering your race and you. So what do you do if a reporter reaches out and says, "Hey, I'm covering X." Well, let's sort of start from the most important thing. You got to respond quickly.
Yeah.
I mean, if you're dragging your feet, waiting until the very last minute to polish up that statement that you're going to email and you're sending it over at 5:30, yeah, it's too late. You're going to be lucky to get your comment in there. Responding to every inquiry is sometimes really hard, especially if you're in a tough spot. But just, you know, getting back to a reporter, and even if it has to be no comment, good to say no comment.
Yeah.
And keep that relationship intact for the next time. I think you're going to get a much better treatment down the road if you're not simply picking and choosing who you're responding back to.
Yeah, and we talked about responding quickly because of the value of your time and the value of reporter's time. But one thing to always keep in mind is that stories are never written and final until they're edited and printed or run on the internet or radio or television. And so you have an opportunity to shape a story at every turn of the wheel. And the earlier you engage with a reporter, the earlier you can begin to shape that story, both through how you frame the issues and by some fairly, you know, easy things that can help the reporter get their job done too as well, like suggesting people for them to talk to about their story who might share your view of the world. So early is good, and it's never too late to shape the story in a way that's more helpful.
Just a note of caution, there are a lot of different, air quote here, reporters out there, and most are reputable, and some are writing for online online blogs and things like that that have huge followings or significant followings in your community. They're all real, but there are some weirdos and some trolls out there. Just know who you're talking to and what it's being used for. People now more than ever try to pin candidates down and get them to say something silly, and the internet makes getting that out there very, very, very easy.
Earned media. One of the least understood facets of the business. In our side of the fence here, we talk about earned media as media that is actually earned by your hard work and engaging with press, as opposed to paid media, which are the campaign ads that you run and pay for. Earned media is an art in many ways, but it's also a science. We've talked about a lot of the scientific aspects, the quantifiable aspects, treat reporters with respect, engage early. But the artfulness of this is in relationship building, and your ability to connect with a reporter on some of the things we've covered, and trust and honesty, being generous with your time, is going to pay dividends for the duration of your campaign. The press release, which can be shortened to PR, is in fact not a PR strategy, as Joe mentioned before. People don't read them. They don't have time to read them, and they assume that they're just going to be saying something they already know. And to be successful at earned media, here are the three things you need to be. You need to be newsworthy. News is called news because it's news and not olds. And so if you call a reporter, you have to have something newsworthy. It has to be relevant. It might be newsworthy, but totally irrelevant in a campaign cycle. Inventing a new form of silly putty is not going to get you coverage. Finally, I think this is really, really important. You need to approach the reporter that you are pitching within the frame that they are approaching their story. And by that, I mean, you'll have a reporter covering your race, and they may be covering it through a purely political lens because they're a political reporter. Perhaps they're covering it through an economic lens because they're an economic reporter. Perhaps they're a gossip columnist and are treating the campaign as a weird sideshow. Regardless of what that frame is, you will be much more successful in getting your story in there if you approach it in the same way. So if you're calling an economics reporter, talk about your economic policy. If you're calling a political reporter, you know, talk to them about your paid media strategy. Talk to something that fits and you'll get in the story.
Yeah, you got to stick with it. This is like one of those things that you're going to feel like you're grinding it out. And in many cases you are. Earned media is hard. Actually, you do have to work it. So I would also say don't be discouraged if, you know, a pitch doesn't go right, or that, you know, the thing that you thought was just absolutely the best idea or the campaign theme you wanted to push that week doesn't get covered. That's normal. And you got to keep after it. So you've been approached by a reporter that wants to talk about something. And in many cases, you may be inclined, if you know the person, just be like, hey, well, just call them right back, right? I know Bob. Bob's great. And just winging it. But having a little bit of consistency in how you prepare for interviews and thinking about these questions prior to going in, you're gonna be more effective and actually help your campaign. Because at the end of the day, you are running, everything you're doing has to have some connectivity to helping you get elected, helping you clear that bar, helping you communicate with voters. So start with, hey, why am I having this interview? And by that, sure, someone may have called you, but you have to have a reason for responding and engaging, and you have to figure out how to use that interview to the best of your ability. So if someone's just calling you, think about what that message is you want to share. Second, start with what may sound like a sort of weird or stilted, I'm trying to sort of be too cute here, but figure out what the ground rules are, right? Especially if you're on TV or radio, or working on TV or radio, is it taped? Is it live? What's the person's deadline? These simple questions that we've outlined here are going to help you prepare for that conversation, whether it's a blogger or your local television news reporter, or say CNN is coming down and something is broken and you're have to work there. Follow those four questions we've outlined there, and you will and you'll be better off with these next parts here.
Ground rules can be something that people forget about, but can be both the cause of and often solution to some of the biggest press problems out there. For those of you who like watching movies, I'd commend to you a movie called The Ides of March, starring George Clooney. A great movie on its own, but there are some very insightful moments in there about the interaction between campaigns and the working press. And the big takeaway there, but also in my own personal experience, and I'm sure Joe's, is that no matter how close you feel with a reporter, whether you're buds, whether you eat dinner together, where you share a few beers at a football game, if you do not say off the record, it is on the record. And so you cannot assume that because you're friends, they are going to not use something.
And they have to agree to it.
Boy.
And they have to agree to it. Just so, because you say off the record does not mean a reporter will agree to it. You have to. Like, you have to make sure that they're there with you, and it's a two-way street.
And don't be afraid to say it several times in the course of the conversation.
We also do a movie review podcast, so check that out later.
Definitely.
Let's keep going. Look, this is sort of what I touched on a little bit earlier, but like everything you say has to have some reason. I know that sounds kind of robotic. But like every story, every media hit, every communication you have has to be something behind it. It has to be part of a strategy you're employing. If a candidate goes out and says 30 different things over the course of 2 weeks, everyone that is listening to that will remember none of them. A good candidate over the course of 2 weeks will say one, maybe two things 30 different times. So remember that you're communicating with voters in all of these scenarios, and have that be your focus. So you can actually have a strategy to get across the story you're currently telling, whether or not it's a TV interview or a radio interview or a press hit. Think about that. And remember, if you have gotten a question that doesn't fit the point in the campaign that you are right now, or you want to pivot to what you want to talk about, do it.
Absolutely.
It's one of the key things that we've talked about in this training before, but I'll have Tony elaborate on that a little bit with sort of answering the question you want to answer.
This is the time-honored and very effective tactic, and you see it with every good candidate, right? It's about staying on message, and it's about your narrative. And as Joe said, you need to decide what you want your narrative to be. When you are talking to voters, what you're doing is establishing an identity in their mind of who you are and what you stand for, and a narrative that you can say comfortably, that feels honest, truthful, and connects with voters is the way you do that. To Joe's point, never answer the question that's asked, right? Answer the question that you want to answer. So if I were to ask Joe, what's your favorite color, Joe would be embarrassed by answering something like mauve or cabernet.
100%.
But what he'd say was, Tony, I'm glad you asked that question, because the spectrum of colors that we have in this country is terribly important, and I support colors, period. And Joe will say that 30 times, maybe 30 different ways over the course of a week. But what he's doing is establishing a narrative that he's a colorful guy. He likes colors.
At the end of the day, this person is interviewing you because you're a candidate for an office. And honestly, that's the easiest pivot you have, right? I mean, the reason you're being asked this question is probably not because you're a policy expert or have written a report that is focused on that thing. No, you're a candidate and you're being asked for your opinion or your position on something. That in its own right is the easiest pivot you have. Mm-hmm. So think about that and just be very comfortable with it. Practice with your team. Have them ask the tough question and you practice pivoting to either a non-answer on that tough question and then getting to the thing you wanna say. If you look at if you watch cable news, and I don't really recommend it, but if you'll notice that a lot of the satellite interviews where there's a member of Congress or a politician that's in front of a camera and has got an earpiece, watch that every once in a while and count the amount of times that person actually answers a question that was asked. It is rare. And then you will see them not stop because it's very clear they did not answer that question, but they're going to get their two cents in. Watch it and sort of use those tips and as best you can, try that on and try to get good at it.
These are things that can help you essentially sound better. It's simple stuff, right? Joe and I are sitting down here. If I were to stand up, my enunciation would become clearer. My voice would become louder. I would sound much more authoritative. But I'm going to sit for now. Just there I am. If you're on the phone talking to a reporter, stand up, right? If you're on TV, stare at the camera. Don't look around too much. Take the time to actually have your physical bearing fit the situation that you're in.
How you present is such an important part of how you communicate. So you may have your message down cold and it could sound great and you may deliver it perfectly, but if you look shifty on camera, people are going to think you're lying. So really think about this, and this is not natural. I remember sort of being thrown into doing TV interviews very early on in my career and thinking to myself, man, there is nothing weirder than talking to this massive machine with this guy who could look like he just could not care less about what I'm saying. Most cameramen pretty much zone out when you're talking. They're worried more about sound and tone and is the camera focused or not. Not what you're saying. It can be a very off-putting engagement. Yeah. So practice it and don't take it personal, but always keep your cool. There is nothing worse than the missed opportunity or having to clean up the mess of you as a candidate just not being able to handle a tough question or someone poking at you.
Yeah.
It's a cardinal sin and really if you're hot tempered and to begin with, do work on it. The worst moments are when someone asks a politician just a straight up question that they just feel like is inappropriate or cuts to their personality or their trustworthiness, and they just lose it. And that reaction is death.
Yes, there are a number of ways to mess that up. But if you keep in the back of your mind that a TV interview, a radio interview, you're not talking to the reporter, you're talking to the voters. And at the end of the day, this is a job interview. You're interviewing for the job of representing your voters. If your demeanor is such that you can't handle a reporter, they're not going to trust you to handle the job.
You would not hire any of your campaign staff if under questioning they freaked out and started yelling. You wouldn't do it. Think about that. Debate prep. You may get one, two, maybe three chances to debate your opponent over the course of a campaign. So being ready for these events matter to voters that are very, very focused. Like they're listening, they're trying to make up their mind. They're high information voters. This is where they are going to make their choice. So think about this. So we've talked about message boxes as part of this training in the past. They are very, very useful. You do not have to overcomplicate this. Know what you want to say about you, what they are going to say about you, what you want to say about them, and what they say about their own candidacy. You have to know these things. Write them out. A debate is a perfect opportunity to do three of these things, the four of them on them, they'll handle on their own. So you on them can be really, can be transformational to a race. I am, in my off time, I help local candidates think through this stuff. And I just went through this with a local mayoral candidate who has the ability to frame the race. It is nobody knows what the choice is. Nobody knows that there's a real choice on the ballot. And I've argued that this is absolutely the right time for them to define the race because they can do it. It's a huge opportunity. That's you on them.
Yep.
Them on you, you got to be able to take a punch and have really solid responses to it. Write them out. Practice the responses. You know what they are. Don't be silly. No candidate is perfect. Know your weaknesses and know how they want to exploit them and have a really good answer for it. And always come back to your core message. What do you want to share to voters? It should be in your back pocket. It should be in your front pocket. It should be the thing you say three times at a minimum over the course of an hour debate. Keep coming back to it.
Yes, and if you've done the very important work that we've discussed in the slides leading up to our next movie segment here, then this should be easy. Because if your narrative is clear and you stick to it, you can pretty much fit anything you want into that narrative. So if your narrative is, I'm a donut salesman, and somebody asks you a question about trade policy, you can say, that trade policy is really going to be good for donut sales. If they ask you a recreational policy, well, you know, after I exercise, I like to eat donuts. I know that's a very strange and counterintuitive example, but the same thing holds true for environmental policy.
Always be prepping. It's not fun, but you can use every little moment of time to prep for debate. If you have time, of course, sitting down and thinking through and running it out and having someone that can play your opponent or your opponents is really useful, but that is not what we mean by this. You can start prepping for a debate 2 months in advance. Write the questions out, write your responses out, put them on flashcards. Work through those flashcards when you're traveling, to a campaign event. Have family, staff, friends. Just think about what the questions could be and have them write out those questions. Really kind of engage the people around you to help with this. There is, a candidate that is prepared for debate is obvious. A candidate that has done nothing and has leaned on his or her own skills is also pretty obvious too. The one thing that people certainly want to find is like a good zinger that people take home. They are practiced. They are not off the cuff. In 10 years in Democratic politics, every zinger that we wrote, if we could, we tested it and really sort of made sure that it was worth using. So it's not quick wit. It's practice.
And we've seen this in recent history and how effective it can be. And once you find something that works, stick with it. This is not a good example of what I would recommend that you do, but it's a good example of how somebody's used this practice. Obviously, President Trump started off somewhere in the middle of the 2016 presidential primary cycle using disparaging adjectives as a predicate to every other candidate's name. Once that worked once, he found one for everybody, and that became strategy, tactic, game over. For the rest of the debates, it was terribly effective, and I wouldn't suggest you do that the same way, but it's a good example of how finding a zinger that reflects how you want to play this thing can really actually work.
I think we're in a moment in time, too, where the pendulum has swung back the other way, that voters, most voters, I say, are looking for candidates that respect one another and don't cross that line. So note that a zinger isn't calling someone, an idiot or what have you. That's not what we mean here.
Yeah.
It is that sort of newsworthy, tweetworthy line that does speak to the state of the race. Maybe it's you, maybe it's your opponent.
Yep. And it also gives voters a quick insight into your personality. I think it's very important.
We've been talking at these nice folks for a while, but let's spend a little bit of time on contrast here, because this is setting up that choice that I think is really, really. You want to just jump in?
Yeah, absolutely. I think this is a fantastic time to talk about this in American politics, because everybody wants to be different than the other guy right now. Whether you're a Republican in the Congress who wants to be different from the White House, whether you're a Democrat who wants to be different from some longtime leaders of the party, everybody just wants to be different. Now, there's a lot of flux in the system. And it's a great opportunity. And the important thing I see on this slide here is that contrast does not mean you need to attack your opponent. That is probably sort of the lowest probability move that's going to get you to stand out from the pack or stand out from your opponent. This is really about your narrative and sticking to your narrative and going back to where we started, which is values. You want your voters to think that you are more like them than the other guy. That's basically the calculation. And you guys are going to know your voters better than us. But I'd seriously urge to find all the data that you can get your hands on that tells you the most that you can possibly learn about the value systems of your constituents and figure out how you are closer to that than your opponent and drive it home.
This is incredibly important for folks running in primaries where there may be a lot of agreement on the core issues, but you have to set up that choice for voters. You may agree on 90% of the issues. Maybe it isn't pointing out that 10%. Maybe it's suggesting that you are the better equipped, better prepared candidate to make those issues happen or make that thing happen. There are many ways to do this.
And I think, look, it's really easy on our stuff, on environmental issues, it's easy to connect, right? And so hypothetical primary, that Democratic primary, every Democratic candidate wants to do the right thing on climate change. Every Republican primary candidate is for an all-of-the-above energy policy. Okay? There's not a lot of differentiation there. But where you can actually stand apart is to explain to your voters why you want to do something about climate change. Well, that's going to vary by district. Some people want to do it because the sea's rising around them. Other people want to do it because it's an economic opportunity. As a Republican, you might support an all-of-the-above energy policy, but energy is going to look different in your district. In some places, that's going to mean that you're a strong supporter of wind. In other places, it's going to mean that you are a strong supporter of solar or geothermal or hydro. So figure out a way to connect with your voters that speaks to their values, that sets you apart on what otherwise might be a completely homogenous policy set.
Great point. In the moment, I don't know if most folks have not, it'll be a really sort of surreal moment to be standing on a stage or sitting at a table with your opponent, primary or otherwise, being asked questions with multiple cameras on you or it being recorded. It's a strange, strange time. You actually can't practice that. In the moment, on stage, it is its own very odd moment. So just do a couple things. You know, have a plan. Know what you want to say. Get those message boxes down and be very comfortable with what to say. Try to answer them in the shower as you're driving around. Just have that stuff locked down. Know the issues you want to share and keep your cool. Really, really quite simple recommendations here. But then also, don't be a punching dummy, right? I mean, know how to push back if someone attacks you or sets up something that you completely disagree with. Don't be afraid to mix it up. And we've said this time and again. Keeping it local, keeping the issues as close to your voters as possible, is really the best advice that I think fits regardless of whether you're running for mayor or Congress.
Yeah, that's right. And when somebody goes negative on you and it's an ad hoc attack, meaning that it's about you and your character rather than policy issues that are under debate, remind the voters that. Quite often, if a candidate runs out of things to say on a policy, they'll attack you because they've run out of things to say of substance. And so remind the voters that you're here to talk about substance and policy that matters to them. Your opponent clearly doesn't have any other good ideas, so all they can do is attack you.
Nice little pushback. Every, you don't have to wait for a debate. you can make these happen. A lot of times they're not that perfect TV moment. They are in community halls across the country. Push your communities to hold conversations. They are as debatey as you get without, again, the cameras and the podiums.
Yeah, and if your opponent disagrees to join you, do it anyway.
It is quite awkward debating a cardboard cutout of your opponent. However, Kinko's is pretty adept at making these things happen. Mm-hmm. Try it out. You'll get some media coverage out of it. And again, have a little fun with it. Mm-hmm. Because if your opponent does not want to debate you, I imagine that is a pretty press-worthy thing that I would pivot to the first part of the presentation.
Indeed.
All right. Wrap it up there, my friend.
I think we've talked about this a lot. So I'm going to keep it simple and keep it local and speak to values. Again, keep it simple, keep it local, and speak to values. If you do that, you can't lose. It's when you stray from the simple and the local and the values of your voters that you can commit unforced errors and get crosswise with things you really shouldn't have to be worried about.
Let's take some questions.
All right, guys, thank you so much for this presentation. So I have a few questions for you all. So what is the best way for someone to get comfortable with sticking to talking points? They don't want to sound like a robot.
Yeah, Joe mentioned something really important earlier, and this is going to be something that you have to figure out on your own. But the guys who are really good at this and the gals who are really good at this, figure out ways to say the same thing over and over again, 30 or 40 different ways. And if you can figure that out, spend some time doing it, right? On our issues, keeping it simple and sticking to talking points, if you want to convey the fact that you're an environmentalist, have a dozen things to say about that. I support clean water. Everybody breathes the same air. I don't want my kids playing in garbage. Everybody should recycle, right? So you're saying I'm an environmentalist in very simple and local ways over and over and over again. Too boring. Or boring yourself, but you're just reinforcing that narrative.
Yeah, it's one of those things where I've seen people that are really, really good at it and folks that have struggled with it. But even politicians that I've worked with that have struggled with it recognize that it's so important because most people's natural inclination is to do everything we just told them not to do, answer the question as it was asked. Try to be an issue expert on absolutely everything. Make every response fit exactly to whoever's in front of them, right? If someone came up and asked me about any number of issues, I'd have no idea how to answer them. Mm-hmm. But my natural inclination would be make something up. So in many ways, sort of being really comfortable with your core messages. And finding those unique ways to come back to them that feel right to you, it should be communications strategy 101. And folks at this point in a campaign cycle, if you haven't committed to doing that, I think now's the time because you're going to get way too close to election day. Where the closer you get to election day, if you are not going back to the one or two themes that you've been pushing in your paid, in your debates, in your media, if you as a candidate are not ready to do that, you're probably not going to win.
When should I consider going negative, and when should a candidate not go negative?
That is a very interesting question in these interesting political times. I think Joe mentioned this before, and we see this in the data. And we here at EDF and EDF Action do quite a bit of paid advocacy in the media space. So we've got a lot of data on what works and what doesn't work. Going negative, it's a very low percentage play, right? When you go negative, you are simply telling people why you personally don't like the other guy. You're not telling them why they should like you. And so being positive about yourself, about your message, about what you're trying to achieve on your constituents' behalf is always the better play. I think voters are tired of negative politics. Joe mentioned this. So the first question should be, rather than when do I go negative, How can I always go positive and how many different ways can I do that? It doesn't mean you're not going to get in some wrestling matches, and you're going to have to figure that out. If somebody goes negative on you, you don't want to shy away from that and be perceived as somebody who just runs away from a fight. That is never a good thing in politics. But you do have to figure out a way to do that that reminds voters again why you reflect their worldview, their values, and be positive about being negative.
Without disagreeing with that, I have a bit more bare knuckle feeling on negative campaigning, having been part of numerous truly ugly races for Congress. I don't say that proudly; it's just true. And disqualifying your opponent in some way is sometimes, oftentimes, really, really necessary. There are a number of occasions where that I can think of that a candidate that I've advised or worked for has been so far ahead that there is no need to take his or her opponent down a notch. But in most cases, in some of these coin flip races, that your team will push you to approve a negative paid communication. And I think, again, unless you're running away with it, you have to consider it has to be part of your ability to go to win. That is different than in personal meetings and personal events where you're with another candidate or you as a candidate are talking. I think you have to be very, very careful about sort of carrying the negative in those things. It can absolutely backfire.
Oh, absolutely. And this is actually really fun stuff. And the higher you guys get in the electoral system as you move from county council up to a statewide office or the Congress or beyond, the more sophisticated the opposition negative work gets. And it's just something you're going to have to deal with. I mean, there is not a single well put together campaign out there that does not engage in negative opposition research and figure out ways that they might use that in the future. It doesn't mean they're going to. So you just need to be smart and aware of that stuff. What I find fascinating is the bar of disqualification keeps getting farther away, right? So you could go negative, but I think we've successfully redefined bad you can be before it actually disqualifies you these days. I mean, we see this at the congressional level, at the presidential level. You can get away with a lot more than you used to be able to and still hold on.
100%. And, I'm not going to go negative, Tony, in this event right here, but I will send some mean mail later undercutting his presentation.
Yeah, so totally.
Wait for that.
Yeah, I'll do an inter-office email.
Very much looking forward to it. All right, so certain politicians are having a lot of success communicating without a filter. Should I do that as a candidate?
No.
No. Definitely not.
You won't get away with it. Simple as that.
No.
I can count on a number of hands, like politicians, that somehow have gotten away with it. And I have. There are way more politicians that you've never heard of that have tried it and have lost. Don't do it.
Yeah. Not a good idea. Hire a good team. They're your best filter.
All right. So if I'm running for office and my opponent has made strong efforts to box me in on my support for environmental issues, and it seems to be working with a subset of voters, how do you get yourself out of the box?
I'm going to be repetitive and reinforce my narrative and stay on my talking points here. The best way to get out of that box is to just speak directly through the walls of that box to your voters. You can always overcome a negative portrayal of your environmental position by speaking directly to your voters about why you care about the air that your children breathe, the water that your families drink, and the health and safety of your neighborhood. That will break any box that your opponent tries to put around you. The mistake that people make is try to counter an attack on environmental policy with a smarter response on environmental policy. Voters don't go that deep on these issues, but they are very, very deep on their feelings for their communities and their natural surroundings. I mean, this goes for Republicans, it goes for Democrats. Everybody cares about the country that we live in and their personal health and safety.
Yeah, think about the pivot. Think about how that attack boxes them in. In many cases, you can turn it right back around and suggest that they're trying to appeal to a very narrow subset of voters that in most places is not the majority of voters.
Let's be frank here, or a narrow minority of special interests.
Absolutely.
Not even voters.
Yep.
But, you know, too often environmental conversations and policies are driven by the narrow set of special interests that have specific wants, desires before policymakers at the state and federal level. And they tend to dominate the conversation. You're never going to outspend those guys, but you can certainly outvalue those guys, right? Your voters care more about themselves than they do about a special interest who's pushing for a particular policy.
All right. So assuming I have done everything you guys have advised me to do as a candidate, I've built relationships with some reporters and I've made the effort to be responsive and quick and all that kind of good stuff. How would you handle a crisis, a scandal?
You know, we can make this really hard, and there are people that are paid very good money to step in and handle communications. But I think it's pretty simple. You tell the truth the first time. You don't have the drip, drip, drip of whatever the next step is. You get out ahead of it. You deal with it aggressively. Do everything you possibly can to have it be a 1 or 2 day story at the most. And the people that mess up try to push the blame or push it off on something else. They try to hide a piece of the actual conversation. Like, every time I've seen it extend past a day or two, it is because the response is someone trying to be too cute or trying to dig in and fight. Almost every good crisis ends in a day or two if the person deals with it head on and is truthful from the get-go.
Yeah, look, Joe, that is exactly right. And I want to emphasize one thing that Joe mentioned there. If the crisis is not of your own making, if somebody is manufacturing a crisis for which you have to pay attention to, you better be honest about everything right away, because I'll bet you that whoever's manufacturing this crisis is holding in advance a lot of information, and they're just going to put it in front of reporters every day until the election.
That's right.
Drip by drip by drip. And so you got to be quick, you got to be honest, and you have to be thorough. And frankly, you know, your best hope in these situations is to divine the story before anybody else does. And that's why you can't wait, right? If something comes across 9 o'clock in the morning, you got to be out there at 9:30 talking about it, being honest about it, and framing the story on your terms, because the longer you wait, other people are going to jump right in there.
You know, and you shouldn't be caught off guard by these things. You should go into every campaign, again, mayor to Congress, with an idea of what your weaknesses are, and have been working on a crisis strategy on things that we all have that could be twisted or sort of used to try to peel votes away from you. Don't be silly. If you start a campaign and you have a really sort of messy divorce record out there, you got to be honest with your team about that and know that is absolutely coming. You can't just sort of think it's not. So doing a little prep work in advance is also a really key piece of it. If you're getting caught off guard by something, your team's getting caught off guard by something, you've actually done something wrong prior.
Yeah, and can I say one more thing about this? There's a huge opportunity cost in letting a story like this, whatever it might be, roll on, right? Every time you've got to respond to something and explain something, you're not talking about what you want to be talking to voters about. Campaigns do not go on forever. Time is limited. Voters' attention to what you're saying is limited. There's a lot of competing noise out there. And every time you're just explaining something that you didn't want to have to talk about, you're not talking about what you do want to talk about. So move fast.
I can't believe your restraint and all the Trump jokes that I know were going through your head that you didn't make.
I had a couple of Louisiana ones I was ready to tee up, but I know the joke comes out of that world, so I didn't want to embarrass him.
We're on best behavior today.
Yeah.
All right. So finally, how should a candidate remain focused on their values in this crazy news cycle?
It's hard, right?
It is.
I mean, it's a tough question. I'm sure there are reasons why people run for office that are, you know, they want to climb the ladder or things like that. But for the most part, what it is hard work. It is, it pulls at your family, it pulls at your time, you end up with less money. Like, there are very few reasons to actually run. So this is not the convincing people to run section of our training. But I think you find you run because you want to do something good and you want to make something better, and coming back to that as what drove you to run in the first place, that sort of mooring to the, you know, the campaign and why you're doing it is incredibly important. It has to be there, and if it's there, I think the value is attached to that.
I totally agree. And, you know, Morgan, that's a great question, because candidates today, I think, have to be, or attempted to be, more reactionary than they ever have been in history, because there's just so much going on and so much to react to. Federal level, at state level, globally, I mean, there's just a lot happening right now, and a lot of it is unprecedented in terms of both politics and policy. Joe's right. Like, if you don't have a good reason to run for office that you can explain in 10 words or less to your voters, you shouldn't be doing it. And when you're forced into a situation where you have to be reactionary, use that as an opportunity to pivot back to why you're running for office, period.
Cool. Well, I think that's all I have for questions, guys. Thank you so much for your time.
Thanks, all. Everybody, go win.
That was fun.